Can I pray for us before we start? Pray with me, would you? Father, you are the great Creator. You alone are worthy of all worship and honor and praise. And we know that you alone should get that praise from us. We pray that we could offer that to you now. Thank you for your goodness to us, for bringing us to this conference. I pray that you would give me your words to say. I pray that you would keep back anything that isn't true and put forth the things that are. Help us all to glorify you with the time that we share together in this room today. In the name of Jesus, amen. Right, so we're going to talk about creation and creativity and the work of art. So let's start with the scriptures and creation, shall we? Can I read you the most familiar passage? In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Now the earth was formless and empty. Darkness was over the surface of the deep, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the waters. And God said, "Let there be light." And there was light. God saw that the light was good, and he separated the light from the darkness. God called the light day, and the darkness he called night. And there was evening, and there was morning, the first day. And God said, "Let there be an expanse between the waters to separate water from water." So God made the expanse and separated the water under the expanse from the water above it. And it was so. And God called the expanse sky, and there was evening, and there was morning, the second day. And God said, "Let the water under the sky be gathered to one place, and let the dry ground appear." And it was so. God called the dry ground land, and the gathered waters he called seas. And God saw that it was good. And then God said, "Let the land produce vegetation, seed-bearing plants and trees on the ground that bear fruit with seed in it, according to their various kinds." And it was so. The land produced vegetation, plants bearing seed according to their kinds, and trees bearing fruit with seed in it according to their kinds. And God saw that it was good. And there was evening and there was morning the third day. And God said, "Let there be lights in the expanse of the sky to separate the day from the night, and let them serve as signs to mark the seasons and days and years. And let there be lights in the expanse of the sky to give light on the earth." And it was so. God made two great lights, the great light to govern the day and the lesser light to govern the night. He also made the stars. God set them in the expanse of the sky to give light to the earth, to govern the day and the night, and to separate light from darkness. And God saw that it was good. And there was evening and there was morning, the fourth day. God said, "Let the water teem with living creatures, and let birds fly forth from the earth across the expanse of the sky." So God created the great creatures of the sea, and every living and moving thing which the water teems, with which the water teems according to their kinds, and every winged bird according to its kind. And God saw that it was good. God blessed them and said, "Be fruitful, and increase in number, and fill the water of the seas, and let the birds increase on the earth." And there was evening and morning, the fifth day. God said, "Let the land produce living creatures according to their kinds, livestock, creatures that move along the ground, and wild animals, each according to its kind." And it was so. God made the wild animals according to their kinds, and the livestock according to their kinds, and all the creatures that move along the ground according to their kinds. And God saw that it was good. And then God said, "Let us make man in our image, in our likeness, and let them rule over the fish of the sea and the birds of the air, over the livestock, over all the earth, and over all the creatures that move along the ground." So God created man in his own image. In the image of God he created him. Male and female he created them. So God blessed them, said to them, "Be fruitful and increase in number. Fill the earth and subdue it. Rule over the fish of the sea and the birds of the air and over every living creature that moves on the ground." Let's think through just a little bit about what God actually did when he created. First of all, he creates ex nihilo, out of nothing. There's nothing there, and then he speaks, and it is. My Hebrew scholar friends tell me that there are not four words there in that first creative act, "Let there be light." There are only two words. There's light, be. Isn't that powerful? Light be. And it beed. It It existed, boom, out of nothing. Dr. Schaefer, I remember one time saying in one of his books, saying, drawing a circle on the board and saying, everything that exists is inside this circle. And then he erased everything and said, this is what it looks like for there to be nothing. And then he said, almost. And then he erased the circle and said, this is nihilo, this is nothing. And it's out of that that all things are created. Another thing that we ought to bring that warrants our attention is that he created things by the spoken word. He spoke things into existence, that words matter. Language is essential. It's not peripheral. It's essential. It's in language that things occur. It's in language that things have their being. And so it's not surprising then in the New Testament that we hear Jesus described as the one in whom all things have their being. He is the Word. And in the Word, all things are held together. From Him and through Him and to Him are all things. And He's called the Word. So it shouldn't surprise us that language is the way that God created. He spoke things into existence. He didn't just think them into existence. He spoke them. He brings, thirdly, order out of chaos. We're told that there's such a thing as chaos, and he brings order to it. He brings form out of formlessness. He brings light out of darkness. He divides and excludes in order to make those divisions. He divides sky and water, earth and sea, makes definition and says, this far. He speaks to the sea and says, thus far and no further you go. He creates things that bear fruit. That is, they have their own seeds within them. From the time that they're created, they are always going to bear their own replacements. They're pregnant, as it were, with their own next generation. He makes a distinction between the sun and the moon. He brings a distinction between original light and reflected light that's very important. He brings diversity and unity in animals. He speaks in terms of birds, and then when we see birds in the world, we recognize that that word birds, that unifying word bird, is full of thousands of different kinds of birds. Great diversity within that one unity. Same thing for fish or people, for that matter, human beings. All you have to do is look around you, next to you, and you'll see just how diverse we really are. We don't look at all the same, do we? What a wonderful thing that is. It's a great thing. Then, he actually creates someone in his own image. Up until the time that he creates man and woman, nothing is claimed to be in his image. So there's a uniqueness to the creation of Adam and Eve, that they are the first that actually bear something of his image. And the image includes not just the form, who knows what that is, the form of God, but other qualities, other characteristics, like the ability to make things. Now, God creates out of nothing. We don't do that, do we? When we create things, we don't create out of nothing, but we do create out of the things that he's given us. Before we made it, it didn't exist, and after we made it, it did. It's a sort of strange and wonderful capacity that he's given us to create. And, of course, he's given us some of the qualities that he's given the rest of creation. That is, we can reproduce as well. But for human beings, it's a conscious thing. It's not an instinct, necessarily. It's a choice that we make to reproduce. And the way we reproduce matters to God, as you might imagine. So mankind bears the image of the Creator in his choices to create. At least that. I'm not saying that's exclusively it, but that's at least it. So we're commanded by God to be fruitful and multiply. And the first thing he does is tell us to do two things in particular. Name the animals and tend the garden. And when he's given a woman, Adam composes the first poem. He says, you are bone of my bone and flesh of my flesh, and I will call you woman because you came out of man. He's overcome with someone who's like him and yet so unlike him. In fact, she's from Venus, I'm told. After the tragic fall, Adam names his wife Eve. And Eve means living, because all of the human beings from this point on are going to come from her. She is the source of life that way. Now, you don't find monkeys or oak trees naming anything. You don't find monkeys or oak trees writing poems or being consciously creative or reproductive. And this practice of naming things and writing love poems and songs has never let up. It's a human characteristic that continues to this day. There will be lots of aspects of life that want naming. There still are lots of aspects of life that want naming. In fact, I heard the other day, maybe you've heard about this, there's a company in, is it Switzerland, that will sell you a star. Do you know about this? You can name this star. There are so many stars out there that you can't possibly name them all. They're just out there with no names, you know. So for, I don't know, $29.95, you can sort of give your girlfriend a star or something, you know. Is it more than that now?
Probably.
Stars are probably more expensive than I give them credit for. Imagine claiming that it's yours to give someone else. That's what I think is astounding. Reminds me of an old joke. An Englishman has gone to Egypt and he's looking for something to take home to his wife, and he stops into a curiosity shop and the guy says, "I know what you need. You need to buy a pyramid." And the man says, "What, a pyramid? Well, how would I ever take it home?" And he says, no, you don't understand. You buy it, and we'll keep it here, and every so often we'll write letting you know how it's getting on. You know, I mean, how on earth are you going to take a pyramid home? How can you hand somebody a star? But there you are. We're still naming things, is the point. And strangely enough, you don't find robins and monkeys naming things. They don't seem to have the not only ability, but even interest in naming things. But we somehow want to do that. We want to say, no, that's a blank. And we even argue about it. No, that's not a blank, that's a blink. You know, we have to somehow have the right words for things. It matters a great deal. Well, what I was going to say is that we practice writing love poems, too. And girls, just like Eve inspired Adam to write a love poem, girls are still inspiring boys to write poems, and they seems like going to continue on the way it always has been. Everybody seems to like it, too. I don't know. That's just the way it is. So, well, let's turn, though, then to this human act of creativity a little bit. Clearly, God is creative, but are we creative in the same way? He, as I said, creates out of nothing, but we out of what has been made. Professor Tolkien, used to call this sub-creation. We don't actually create when we write these stories or paint these paintings or build these buildings. We're sub-creating. We're taking from the world that God has created and we're molding smaller things in it. But let's just compare for a second. It may be that he speaks and things exist and that he brings order from chaos, but we have to still use words to fashion things too. We use words and abilities and call things by name to create them. And if he brings order out of chaos, we draw attention to spots in the world and we bring order to them too, in the way that we put together a garden, say, in our backyard, or dinner table, or tell stories. When we're telling stories, more and more fascinated with the idea of telling stories, because when you tell a story, when you retell something that's happened to you, you are discerning, you are taking certain facts and leaving others. You know what I mean? You're choosing what's important, and you're crafting, in a sense, you're crafting reality to convey to another person. It takes creative juices to do that. It's a wonderful thing to be able to do that. I've got a friend back in Memphis, a gal who just seems to be able to always capture the event that has happened in a story. You won't believe what happened yesterday. And everybody instantly wants to know, you know, what happened yesterday. Because she just knows how to see things. And she leaves certain things out. Not that she's, they're just not important to the story. She captures the essence of it and she conveys the essence in such a way as it's very attractive. Well, that's an art form. That's an ability. That's a creative ability, let's call it that. It may be that he brings form from formlessness, as I said before. We show the relationships of elements. When we make things, we bring things together and show their relationship. Say when we're decorating, or when we're choosing clothing to wear, or when we're building buildings or designing paintings. He brings light from darkness. Well, we can do that metaphorically and literally. That is, we can do it through insight. We can, metaphoric light, as it were, we can bring insight to things. We use our minds. But we also build light fixtures, don't we? I mean, we build things that shed light. He brought definition. Well, we do too. In handling words, stories, separating sounds and silence in music, we separate and make distinction between inside and outside, for example. And in this part of the world is very important, by the way. Now, going outside could be very dangerous. Never mind. I'm from Memphis, and it's very warm there, so I thought maybe it'd be a funny thing. Anyway, we make distinctions between being inside and outside. We make a distinction between the frame and what's outside the frame in a picture. We make distinctions between subjects and objects. Distinctions are part of what we do as creative beings. He makes things that we produce. Well, we're working on that, but no cigar yet. Our scientists can't seem to do that yet. But we certainly are a reproduction of his image. He distinguishes between original and reflected light. Well, we know humility as his creatures, and so we realize that we are the reflected light. Knowing what it means to have original light and reflected light, we see ourselves as mirrors rather than as sources, right, as Christians. So we recognize the significance of the moon. We recognize the significance of our lives in him. Let's see here. Hold on. I lost my place. His creation holds simultaneous unity and diversity. And this is very important. This really gets closer and closer to the work of the artist. We attempt to hold together unity and diversity. And we're not satisfied, really, until we have a measure of both as artists. If you've ever tried to create a painting or a flower arrangement or a piece of music, you know that if there's too much unity in the work, it's dull. And if there's too much diversity in the work, it's chaotic and unsettling. Somehow, we want there to be both unity and diversity simultaneously. We're not satisfied with it unless it has both. And you know what? This is not something that Christians think about. Well, it's not only something that Christians wrestle with. Let me put it that way. Anyone who's a human being finds this way. Anybody who's interested in any kind of creative activity finds that this is the case after a while. Nah, I need a little bit more color in it. It's too the same. Or the opposite. Gosh, I've got to have some kind of repeated element here. I've got to have some kind of form to it, some kind of unity in it, or it's just going to be madness. It's just chaos. So we're not satisfied with either end of that spectrum, if that's what it is, end of a spectrum. Well, I can't help but be not surprised. I mean, I'm not surprised by the fact that God himself has created things the way he has in terms of fish and tree and human being like we talked about before. And we're in his image and we're only satisfied with things that he wants us to be satisfied with, whether we recognize it or not. Our creativity extends to nearly everything we do as well. I keep pushing the wrong button here, and suddenly things fall apart. Technique, you know. Making a living requires creativity. We distribute or make things. We make things or distribute what others make. We decorate our homes. We decorate our apartments or our dorm rooms. We cultivate gardens, we write poems, paint pictures, play instruments, we tell stories. So what's the difference then between creative work and a work of art? Well, some would say that the work of art is different in that it serves no function. It's useless. And I'm not sure I disagree. We can be creative about a lot of things, problem solving, cooking, architecture, but we still create something that isn't useless. Sorry, When we problem solve, when we cook, when we design buildings, we could be creative and still create things that are not useless, right? So there's nothing inherently opposite in creativity and usefulness. But when we all agree that they are works of art, when we call something a work of art, aren't we saying that there's something about that object that is especially brilliant or graceful or profound or beautiful, quite apart from or almost in addition to, beyond its usefulness? There's some aspect that is beyond use, not instead of use, mind you. I'm not saying you can't be useful, but beyond this usefulness. If you took this element away, you'd still have a building, maybe not a great one, but a building. You might still have a meal, maybe not a great one. The building would still keep the rain off, maybe, and the meal might still fill the stomach, but it lacks the element that it makes it what we instinctively call a work of art. Is that element, what is that element? Genius? What is it? Or is it just an understanding of how elements fit together, how proportions are just right, how the whole, for example, is echoed in the parts? When God created, He had no use to fulfill in His creation. He didn't need to make anything. He made purely out of a love of making. And while He has a plan for His creation, He didn't need to make it. It was, in that sense, useless. Now, He had a plan, mind you. I'm not saying He's not far more thoughtful than our wildest imaginations give Him credit for. But in the sense of it being necessary, it wasn't useful. It was useless. And in this way, our art, can actually aspire to great heights by also aspiring to be useless. Now, when He made it, it was not to fulfill a need He had. It was almost like, I don't want to be blasphemous here. Understand, that's not my intention. But it was almost like a hobbyist. He did it because he loved it. He did it because he liked doing it. I think it was Lewis maybe that said he was just overflowing with creativity. It just burst out of him. He just did it. Light be. Cool. You can see him doing that. That's kind of what he did too, you know. He says, light exists, and it did, and he called it good. Now, I know this sounds silly, but the reason that he does this thing, well, hang on, let me back up a second and say this. If it's like a hobbyist, if it's done out of the love for it, then you could, in one sense of the word, say that God's creativity is the creativity of an amateur. Because an amateur, after all, is one who loves. That's what the word means, right? One who does it because he loves it. Now, I know this sounds silly, but the reason it does is that we have attributed a certain weight to the word professional. Where does that weight come from? In the most important things, it's a shameful thing to be a professional. Let me say that again. In the most important things in life, it's shameful to be a professional. Anyone who is a professional lover is a shameful person. Anyone who is who is professional about his patriotism, which is just another kind of love, love for country, used to be and may still be that professional athletes are barred from international Olympics. It seems like they had professional basketball players though the last few years, didn't they? But it used to be you couldn't actually participate in the Olympics if you'd ever been paid for the sport that you're working, that you're doing. Somehow, the purest form of athletic competition, they considered, was done for the sake of the competition itself and the aspirations of finding the height of human ability in that particular sport. And being paid to do it somehow clouded that issue. We admire lovers not because they are indifferent to the good that can be had through love. Don't get me wrong. They're not indifferent. They simply want the proper result of love. They want marriage. The proper end of the thing that you're desiring is a noble, a laudable thing. It's when we substitute another end for that love that we find it prostitution, in the most general of senses. The right desire, we admire lovers not because they're indifferent to good, but because they have the proper result in mind. Marriage, commitment, family, oneness. As soon as we hear or even suspect that a lover loves because of the money he'll receive in getting married, we're repulsed. It's suddenly tawdry and low. It's professional. When someone's willing to fight for the love of his country, we call him a hero. As soon as we hear that he will sell himself to whichever side in the war pays the most, we call him a mercenary, a professional. In each case, his love is transferred to himself and what he can get out of the marriage or the war, rather than to the wife or the country that he claims to love. There is still passion, still enthusiasm for a goal, but the goal is not the natural one for either love or war. Don't we think this way a little bit about art, too? When we find an artist who's willing to speak, to work hard and to speak a genuine sentiment through his work, the sort of expression that is natural for the goal of art, we're impressed. Even if we don't like the art or the sentiment, we're still impressed. However, as soon as we find or even suspect that the artist thinks the goal of the artwork is to make himself famous or rich, we find that the enchantment is broken. We start to think the entire enterprise is compromised or trivial. Even in popular music, I remember when I was in junior high school, we used to talk about certain bands being really great until they went commercial. Yeah? We lose interest in their work somehow because they've suddenly given up their whatever artistic vision they had in order to sell more records. It's a sort of compromise that's unflattering and professional. Now, in the midst of this, I want you to know that I don't think it's the least bit wrong for an artist to sell his work. Don't misunderstand me. Or to make a living from the work of his hands. I'm only trying to describe the sensation we all feel when we find that a person we thought was doing something for love, getting married, going off to war, creating something, is doing it primarily in order to make money or become famous or something. When an artist creates out of integrity, that is, the purpose and the expression are the same, and he sells it because it's considered well done, then I think we all ought to cheer. That's a great thing. There's nothing wrong with that. When we speak casually about someone's ability or talent or significance, we speak of his professionalism in a positive way. So the word professionalism often is bounced around on a sort of superficial level as a very positive thing. If we said that he were an amateur, it would be taken to mean that he's only dabbling. He's not serious about his work. But this practice should be questioned, I think. Often it's the amateur who loves the activity for its own sake, and the professional who becomes jaded and learns to hate the activity, hardening his heart toward the activity and seeing it as a meal ticket. Now, I don't know about you. If you've spent any time with professional artists, you know that that's the case. I know some very dear friends of mine who have become, who are musicians, orchestra musicians, who have lost almost all of their love for what they do. They in school, when we knew each other in school, they were, you know, enthusiastic. They wanted to learn how to play the cello so well. They wanted to be able to express this beautiful music for its own sake. They loved what they were doing. And then they became professionals. And they got into the work and they realized, this is my meal ticket. And slowly it became a job, just like every other job. And now, I was talking to a friend of mine just the other day, and I said, what are you going to be doing on your vacation? And he said, I'm putting my cello away, and I'm going fishing for 2 weeks. You know, I want to get as far away from music as I can. Well, what a sad thing, isn't it? I'm sympathetic with it. I mean, people say, you must have this music going on in your house all the time. No, no. Because if I do, it just becomes wallpaper to me. It's no longer a meaningful thing, see? So I like silence, frankly. I I asked a waitress in a restaurant one time how much it would cost to buy a half an hour of silence. She didn't think it was funny. What would you do? She looked sort of concerned, you know, like, you mean turn the music off in the restaurant? I don't understand. Yes, please. So, when, I want to ask the question, how is it that we've come to the point where we do nearly nothing out of love and choose what we do because it makes more money than something else? How is it that we get to that point? The significance placed on the idea of the professional is the result of a culture, I argue, that has decided that this world is all there is. That there's no reason to spend our lives attempting to gain anything in the next life. But the amateur is the one who does something simply because he loves it. He's decided that the thing he loves is worth pursuing for its own sake, not for the further end of a living, and makes this thing, whatever he's pursuing, makes living worthwhile, not makes living possible. And what we love, ladies and gentlemen, shapes our souls. What we love shapes who we are. It's not surprising that God would say, you want to know the most important thing? Love the Lord your God with all your heart and all that you are, and love your neighbor as yourself. And he tells you that not just to say, this is the rules. This is the best thing in the world for you. You want to be a fully orbed human being? Choose carefully what you love. And let me tell you what the best thing, he says. Let me tell you what the best thing is to love. Love me. And then love your neighbor as yourselves. It shapes your soul. If God created out of love, perhaps we should see the value of amateur creation. The fact that we as a culture seem to respect professionalism more than amateurism is a comment partly on how thoroughly this materialist view of life has captured our imaginations. We can't imagine doing anything for eternity's sake or for the shape of our souls, that is, for its own good. Only purposes in this world carry the weight of significance in our minds. How do we get to this point? And what damage has it done to our understanding of art and life in general? C.S. Lewis wrote, quote, friendship is unnecessary, like philosophy and art. It has no survival value. Rather, it is one of those things that gives value to survival. We speak of professionalism as though it were a good thing. Lots of talent or skill is required for professionalism, but amateurism, on the other hand, is typically a poor quality, we figure. But those who create out of love for the action, out of love for the creation itself, perhaps these are the most godlike in their work. The reason we assume amateurism is going to result in poor quality is because we only value what brings us money. What if we valued what God valued and spent our lives doing what we found He wanted us to do? Trusting that He would take care of us as He does the birds of the air, as He tells us. Jesus told us the birds and the flowers are well treated and He loves us much more than those. Why don't we trust Him? It's not just that we're afraid we have to provide something for ourselves. It's that once we go down that road even a little bit toward providing for ourselves, there is never any end of it. We can never provide enough for ourselves. We have this strange illusion that we are providing for ourselves anyway. But we can't do it. Then if we agree that self-provision is the way to go, if we mistakenly agree that self-provision is the way to go, then the result is we begin to envy and covet what others have. We find that we can't be satisfied except with more and more. And then we, the last line is to advertise. then we advertise to each other to take advantage of that dissatisfaction, and professionalism is born. Who can be the most efficient? Who can make the most money? We hear regularly about how we should stop and smell the roses, and I think whenever anybody tells you that, even though it seems like a cliche, you're haunted by it. It sort of haunts you. Wait a minute, maybe that is what life is all about. Not just the superficial, but the profound. When Lewis, talking about Lewis again, said, I think I may have told you some of this before, that Lewis at one point tells a little story about a man in his garden, and he's pruning his roses, and he stops to pray, and he says, "Thank you, God, for these beautiful roses." He's just sort of overwhelmed by the gorgeousness of these beautiful, beautiful plants. And God speaks back to him, and he says, "You're welcome." And he says, "But just wait. Just wait. Just wait until you see an unfallen rose. Because, you know, sin has damaged even the ground that we work with. Everything is tainted." And then he says, "And just wait till you see an unfallen rose through unfallen eyes. It's going to be a day." So, stopping to smell the roses is not a small thing. And we're haunted by the idea that somehow beauty is important, that we really can't satisfy ourselves, that only God can satisfy us. Maybe we should be doing things that we love, that is, things that He teaches us to love. We're dismayed when we hear of someone spending his entire life doing a job that he hates. Now, don't misunderstand me. I know very well that this is a fallen world and that the ground is not going to give us a living without a lot of hard work. But the picture of the man who does what he loves and trusts God to provide for his needs is a picture of joy and a picture of a parallel to the work of God. The work of art requires skill, certainly, but it also requires that it be made for the sheer delight of making. For the sheer delight of the object itself. Just as God loves and delights in you, His object. This is creativity, and the result is the work of art. The philosophers would say that art is made for contemplation, for the simple reason of the beauty of it all. Somehow, beauty is worth having. Somehow beauty is worth exploring. Somehow beauty is worth working to achieve. In Psalm 27, David says, verse 4 I think it is, David says, "One thing I ask of the Lord, one thing I desire, that I may dwell in the house of the Lord all the days of my life." Do you know what the next line is? "To gaze upon the beauty of the Lord." You see, beauty in this world isn't accident. Beauty in this world isn't momentary, trivial diversion. Real beauty in this world is a flash, a momentary glimpse of something of the beauty of God. And it's not surprising that when we see something deeply beautiful, we find that we hurt. We ache. I find myself weeping. Why is that? Well, back to Lewis for a second. He says, the reason that we find that ache and that longing is that for a moment, for that flash, we get a picture of our real situation. We are diverted to such a degree in our lives. We're diverted by our work, our television programs, and finding a way to change the oil in the car, and so on. We're diverted by our daily grind, and by the hundreds and hundreds of different ways that we entertain ourselves, that we don't really have very often that we come into contact with the real situation. That is, that we are created creatures, that we are separated somehow from this God that made us, and we don't exactly know why, and we can't figure our way back. We're lost. Lost in the cosmos, as Walker Percy put it. And we long to be filled with God, and we aren't. And even as believers, even as the faithful, when we come to the point where we know who we are in Him and we know what He's done for us, we're still not there yet. There's still a consummation waiting. We're still not completely satisfied. And so when we see this little bit of beauty, we're momentarily brought face to face with the true situation. That is, that we are not home yet. And it hurts. And yet, Lewis says, that pain I would rather have than anything else in the world. I would rather feel that ache than anything else. I look for it. I walk toward it every chance I get. This is the purpose of art.
Did you say that again?
This is the purpose of art? Which bit?
Right before that.
Let's see. Started with the creation. That the ache, the pain that we experience in this world is a momentary glimpse of our true situation. And that we are going to find that we're not satisfied until we're one with Him. And so we're seeing momentarily something of what it means to be aching, something to be longing. We're falling short of where things are and how they are. Do we go until what?
Quarter till?
Great. Well, I'll tell you what I'd like to do now, if it's all right with you. I'd love to talk with you about this and get your sense about it. I tried to give you a little sense of creation, its connection to our creativity, and then what we mean by and the purpose of the work of art. But this always brings up all sorts of great conversations, so I thought maybe we'd take the last 20 minutes or so that we have and talk about it. So, what do you think? Yes, ma'am. Right.
No, it just seems to me that there is some God-given universal sense that there needs to be a balance between these things.
In the 20th century, I think one of the biggest problems we've had is that the unity between truth and beauty was separate, was split. So that artists felt like they were forced into the position of either telling the truth or creating beauty, but not both. You see? And most of the ones that we think of as the great 20th century artists, opted for truth. And they felt like they were being honest. They were being true to their form. You know, the Picasso, for example, and Braque and others early on. But also the Surrealists and the Dadaists and everyone else. So I think there was a false division between the two. And as a result, they had to pick one or the other. And the problem is this. They looked at someone who would create beauty and say, here's your beauty, but it's without truth. And so it's no longer profound. You know, it's trivial. It's sugary. It's like sugary icing or something. It's not substantial. It's not telling the truth anymore. And the truth, after all, is essential. So beauty got a bad rap, starting with the Enlightenment, but by the 20th century, it really started falling on hard times because beauty couldn't be taken seriously. Now, I think it's a false dichotomy, and I think truth, goodness, and beauty are all to be found in the glory of God. So, yes, I think there has to be some kind of objectivity about beauty in music in particular, but in aesthetics across the board. Now, putting your finger on it is always a very hard thing to do. But one of the ways I think that Christians could do this is to start with Christian theology, as we should in any other endeavor, Start with our understanding of who God is, and then work our way forward from there. I tried to do a little of that tonight, today with this picture of creativity. But imagine these two doctrines that we hold to be orthodox. That is, one, the Trinity, and two, the Incarnation. Both of those have unity and diversity simultaneously, right? Just as the creation itself has the sort of fingerprint of unity and diversity, God, when he walks the earth, has it. Here is the eternal God who's timeless and the creator of all things, walking in the dirt. It's sort of like going to see Othello on the stage and having, in the middle of the second act, having Shakespeare walk onto the play as a character. It's a little like that. And everyone in the play says, "Wait a minute, you made me. How could you be here?" But this combination of the transcendent and the immanent, the transcendent and the physical, invisible, invisible, and so on, all those sorts of divisions come together in him. He's the solution for all the Greek philosophers' problems, too, for that matter, where the problem of the one and the many, as the philosophers tell us. All of that kind of stuff comes together in him. So what if we were to start thinking, as artists, about what it means to put the doctrine of the Incarnation into our work? I don't know what it would look like, but I'm not saying I can predict it. I'm not sure I want to predict it. I just want to do it. It would reflect something profound. The same thing with the Trinity. Here you have one and three at the same time. How can this be? And yet that's at the essence of orthodoxy. So it's not surprising, because we could look at the world and see some evidence of that, even in the sort of fingerprint on the world that God has created there too. So here's the Trinity, one and three, unity and diversity. And the fact that we sort of, I don't know whether the right word is existentially, but experientially, recognize that same thing in our creation, in our own art, that we're not satisfied with it if it's too unified, and we're not satisfied with it if it's too diverse, should tell us something, that may be the road to go. Now, what it won't do is give us what some of us really want, which is a sort of list of 10 or 12 things that have to be in every piece of music in order for it to be considered good. I don't need that. Let's get rid of that. That's not a safe place to go. Besides, it just cramps us, Let's give us the widest possible range, but give us something of God to aim for. That's what I'd like to see happen. Does that help any? I mean, it's not very specific, I know, but it doesn't. There are a lot of good guys writing about this, though, now. If you read von Balthasar, Hans Urs von Balthasar, a Catholic theologian who died just a few years ago, wrote a book called Toward a Theological Aesthetics. Jeremy Begbie has written some about connections between theology and music. Ought to get some of his books. Voicing Creation's Praise, I think, is one of them. What's the other one? Do you guys remember? It's about time, music, time, and... Oh, shoot, I'm sorry. It just skips my mind. Jeremy Begbie, Englishman writing at Cambridge and St. Andrews in Scotland. Who else? Roger Scruton, if you're really interested in aesthetics, Roger Scruton, the philosopher from, I think he's at Cambridge, has written a terrific book on aesthetics of music, and it's brilliant. Just grab that. Gives you a great background. Other questions? I took too long with that one. Sorry about that.
Yes, ma'am. In terms of practical application for that, I was just thinking some of the arts right now, Christian arts are not looked on very fondly.
Why do you think that is? Have you got an idea about why that is? Her question is, she's concerned that Christian art is not looked on by the general public as very high in quality. Is that what you said? Why do you think that is? What's going on? You take a shot at it first if you want to. I'll ask somebody else if you like. A bias. You mean people just inherently distrust or dislike Christianity? Well, there certainly is some of that, isn't there? Yes. You were going to say in the back. Can I ask you first? Did you want to say?
Yeah.
Yes. Okay. Very good. Yeah. No, I see just what you're, I think what I see what you're saying. You're saying that, that because of the fact that they believe to begin with that there isn't any sort of happy ending. I mean, that the life is a meaningless experience. Then for us to sort of paint a picture that there's a happy ending, that there's justice in the world and so on, is a sort of superficial pie in the sky kind of outlook. And so it's not taken very seriously. Is that what you mean? Yeah. Yeah. On prepositions? Propositions. Okay. Excuse me. I misunderstood. Grammar wars. Sorry. Recognizable objects, that kind of thing. Representational art. Yeah. No, that's well said. That's well said. I think that's probably true too. Yeah, you're not really serious if you're describing things simply as they are. There's no insight there somehow. Steve, you want to go next?
Yeah. Just with regard to the question on some Christian art being perceived as being of lesser quality,
mm-hmm.
I think in some ways the Christian certain aspects of the Christian community have tied the hands of Christian artists by either directly or indirectly suggesting that if you are a Christian and an artist, you must produce, quote, Christian art.
Unquote. Ah,
it has to have
right.
A picture of Jesus in it or a scripture.
Or a fish on the bottom.
Yeah, a beautiful sunrise, but a scripture written across
right,
it.
Right,
like
right,
that.
Right. Mm. Sure. Yeah, that's a limiting factor, too. Yes, ma'am.
Amazing Christian art being produced by people who are Christian. But I think part of the last discussion is very informative on the idea of propositional thinking.
Yes.
Versus, you know, undermining narrative, that that if you boil down narrative to a set of principles, you rob it of its power.
I
think there can be a
right.
tendency in a certain
especially right.
coming out of a Christian culture, which in which we are very attached to principles, and for good reason in many cases, but that can sometimes, in another way, tie our hands.
Sure.
That we feel like it has to say a certain thing or certain something, and it's kind of going in the wrong direction.
Uh-huh.
And hopefully, you know, who you are and what you believe and the God you believe in will, you know, inform your narrative, but it isn't where you begin.
Mm-hmm. And somehow telling the story isn't enough. You're forced to go to these sort of diluted principles, or not diluted, but extrapolated principles. And if they're not there, then Christians aren't satisfied with it somehow. Yeah, I think you're onto something. And because really the story is what we've got, isn't it? A lot of the theology is man-made. Yes, in the back. Interesting.
Experience I have when I was in art school as an amateur, I was definitely not making money at all. Losing lots and lots of money to make art. But one of the elders in my church I was involved with comes and said, why would you want to become an artist when you become a missionary? And I think with that kind of attitude, it causes amateur artists to shrink back
of course.
From being noticed. And the ones that are noticed are the ones who are very loud, very boisterous, and who make a lot of money. And so mm-hmm. the professional ones rise very quickly to be seen, but the Christian amateur artists stay on this underground mm-hmm. quiet, oftentimes heard level.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's very interesting. Yes, ma'am.
And I think that the essence, all of you have been alluding to the fact, the reason that people are not appreciative of Christian art is because they're offended by the essence that's coming through the artist into that piece of art. And when you do recognize that each individual has a little piece of the revelation of God, you don't have to look at a piece as being a professional piece. It's an amateur piece. This person has loved what he's done.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
The essence of God has gone into it. And the secular culture is offended by that.
I think you're right, and I certainly don't want to go back on everything I've said in my lecture, but but let me just say, let me just insert right here, that there's an awful lot of amateur art, Christian or not, that's really lousy art, right? Is that okay to say? I'm not, when I said I value what it is about amateurism, what I'm valuing is this love that you're talking about, this enthusiasm for and this creative juices overflowing. However, just like with any gift, we need to train the gift. But we train the gift to glorify God. We don't train the gift to get a job. See the difference? Now, God will provide the job, right? But the training is not for that purpose. So I don't want to leave people with the impression that amateurism is just fine like it is. We can just sort of float through the... We have to go and study. We have to go and sharpen our tools. We have to go and get good at it. And I think that's one of the reasons that people don't turn on to Christianity, because they look at our art and we're willing to be satisfied with sort of third-rate stuff. I heard a guy say one time, the evangelical church can do anything the world does only 5 years later and worse. So what's the point of that? Why aren't we out on the cutting edge? Why aren't we out there doing it out there? Not in terms of progress with a capital P. I'm not looking for modernist progress. I'm looking for insight, profundity, humanness. Why aren't we the ones that capture all that stuff? Yes, sir. You may, and then I'll get over this side. Whose landscape was it anyway?
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly. You know, and there's some things that, you know, when I look at a Bosch painting, it scares the socks off of them. You know, and there's truth in that. And I don't know whether you believe it or not, but even the non-believer can paint truth and bring glory to God.
Right.
Without even knowing.
Right. Right.
So
that's right.
We just need to lose the whole idea that there's Christian art, there's non-Christian art.
What a relief.
Yeah,
I'm with you. I'm with you. Now, over here, we had some. Yes, ma'am. Right. Right.
Quality or the Bible verse on the landscape that in many ways does trivialize or makes it marketable and not of similar quality.
Well said. Yes, ma'am.
I have a different subject.
Good. Well, would you like to say something about this before we leave it?
Sure.
Can you hang on just a second? Hang on just a second long. Yes, sir. Yes. Yes.
Or B, giving Christians some kind of spiritual experience.
Right.
So if it doesn't have one of those two things, it's kind of seen as not very important, worthless, whatever, and it can't stand on its own artistic value.
Yeah. Yeah, I think you're exactly right. You've hit a very important point. The philosophers will tell us there are objects that have intrinsic value and objects that have instrumental value. And goodness is good. It's inherently good. That is, it has intrinsic value. Beauty is like that. Beauty has intrinsic value. Instrumental value is the value that we place on things like money, for example. Money is a very good thing, can be used for good things, but it's not for the paper or the metal itself, it's for what it can get. It's the step towards something else, right? Well, it's the problem comes when we start thinking of art as an instrumental value. That is, it its purpose is to get us to some other experience, or its purpose is to get us, you know, into some frame of mind or mood or something. And that, I think, it can really become propaganda that way. Yes, ma'am, in the back. And then I'll get back to you.
Yeah, I would agree with that. In fact, I don't know if we're talking about music at all, but I don't think we're here to transition to music. And I think that, personally, I can't listen to popular Christian music. It's so sanitized. It's so full of platitudes. It's going to be difficult. And not all Christian popular music, but I know I have a 16-year-old daughter that's local in Minneapolis, the local Christian music scene is very hot right now. And it's a lot of young people, and they're probably not, you know, they probably are amateurs. And, you know, I agree with them.
Sort of unresolved. Yeah, yeah. Let me ask you this. Does that help to answer your question, this discussion, a little bit? That was the point of it, you know.
I think it was kind of about there can't be labels. It has to be real. It seems like everybody's saying it has to be something that is real to get to those truths that are portrayed without a label.
Mm-hmm.
People recognize it both Christians and non-Christians.
I think I would add to that just this warning that I gave over here a second ago, and that is that we as Christians, I think, are so attuned to the sort of propositions that we want to get across that we're so attuned to those things that we're somehow dissatisfied now with the beauty of it by itself, apart from those things. So if we don't see the resolution completely, or if we don't have it all tidy, neat and tidy and all that, then we don't think it's good. What the world looks at it is that it's like it's two-dimensional. It's not got any depth to it, you see. And I think they're right. I mean, in many cases, I think they're exactly right. We're actually shortchanging the very depth of the message that we're trying to proclaim, by trying to reduce it to sort of platitudes and cliches and various things like that. And I'm afraid a lot of popular music, whether it's Christian or not, is platitudes and cliches. You're just giving nihilistic platitudes and cliches, or you're giving Christian platitudes and cliches. I mean, that's sort of the nature, I think, of popular in the hands of the least able. Now, in the hands of the very good, there's a lot of very interesting popular music that's being written. Now, I need to put that aside for a second and go to another subject, and I think you had a question you wanted to ask. And then we'll go. People?
I paint people.
Oh, you paint people, right.
Is that idolatry? Because you think of people as made in his image. That's the one thing I wrestle with, is that I'm making images of, you know what I mean?
That requires a longer answer than I can give you in the couple minutes I've got. Would you mind staying and I'll talk to you about it? Can you stay a minute? Okay. It's time, I think, to quit, so I need to let you go. If you'd like to stay and chat some more, I'll be happy to stay. But thank you all very much.